This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, August 31st, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. Is the Constitution, as Elin Werman argues in his new book, A Debt Against the Living? His introduction to constitutional originalism makes the case that the Constitution is just such a debt. We spoke in July.
Where do we find the genesis of these kinds of arguments about the Constitution? I note that you note a couple of particular quotations from Jefferson and Madison as being particularly important. Where do we find the nut of the argument about the Constitution and what it requires, what it confers?
Well, since you bring up Jefferson and Madison, I always love talking about where the title of the book comes from. And then I guess that'll tie into originalism. So Thomas Jefferson wrote this rather famous letter to James Madison in 1789, in which Jefferson says that the earth belongs to the living. The earth belongs to the living and not to the dead. The dead have neither power nor rights over it. So this letter is often quoted today for the proposition that we should not be bound by the dead hand of the past, by the dead hand of the Constitution. But what's less known is Madison's reply, in which he wrote to Jefferson the following: if the earth be the gift of nature to the living, then their title can extend to the earth in its natural state only. The improvements made by the dead, Madison said, form a debt against the living, who take the benefit of them. This debt cannot be otherwise discharged than by a proportionate obedience to the will of the authors of the improvement. In other words, yes, Jefferson's right. The earth does belong to the living, but only in its natural state. The Constitution, however, is an improvement of such significance upon the natural condition of the world that it can't but create a debt against future generations. And Madison says, the only way for those generations, for we the living, to faithfully discharge that debt is a kind of originalism, by a proportionate obedience to the will of the authors of the improvement, he says. So who's right, Thomas Jefferson or James Madison? And in my book, I answer, by choice of title, I think you could guess, in favor of Madison, originalism, and the original Constitution. So the argument for originalism, I think, is this. Originalism, first and foremost, stands for the proposition that what the law is distinct from what the law ought to be. This, in fact, is how we assess the continuing validity of all laws, right? Whether it's the Alien Tort Statute passed in 1789 or the Defense of Marriage Act enacted in 1996, we first ask, what does the law actually say? What does it do? What legal effect does it have? What does it accomplish in the world? And only then do we ask whether what it says, what it means, or what it does is good. So originalism, first and foremost, stands for the proposition that we should apply this framework for looking at all law to the Constitution itself. We first ask, what does the Constitution say? What does it mean? What does it do? And only then do we ask whether what it says is good, whether it creates a debt against the living generation. So how does the originalist tackle that first question? What does the Constitution say? What does it mean? What does it do? Well, the originalist says that you interpret the words of the Constitution the same way you'd interpret the words of any communication intended as a public instruction. So suppose you find a recipe for fried chicken in your attic and it's dated 1789. Gary Lawson drew this analogy, actually, in a very entertaining Law Review article between reading recipes and reading constitutions. So the originalist says there's no difference. How do you interpret the words of a recipe? How do you figure out what culinary effect, so to speak, it has in the world? You look to the meaning that the words had to the people at the time. So for the Constitution, you look to the original meaning the words had to the framers who wrote the Constitution and the public that ratified it.
Where are we failing with respect to originalism in terms of interpretation? One idea that comes to mind is surveillance, government surveillance of American citizens?
Well, in the sense of what originalism would remedy, or I guess where we're failing in our modern constitutional interpretation, right? I think it's the non-originalist interpretations that are failing in many respects, right? If you believe—
Well, of course you would.
Well, yeah, of course. But in this, I don't think—
So with specific respect to surveillance of Americans, is there an originalist defense to be made for that?
Well, so the first thing to say is that, of course, the Fourth Amendment applies to modern technology, right? This is often a trope that's made against originalism. Well, the founders couldn't conceive of the internet, right? Or they couldn't conceive of GPS devices. Well,
yeah, and yet we have founders who wrote in cipher to each other.
Yes, that's also very true. And so the point then is there's a distinction between the original expected application of the law, right, and the original meaning of the law. The founders wrote, and that was the genius of the Constitution, they wrote standards like unreasonable searches and seizures that can apply to future circumstances. So, for example, of course, the First Amendment applies to the internet. Of course, the Fourth Amendment applies to GPS devices put on cars, even though the founders could think of none of these things. What matters is what they wrote. And what they wrote were standards that could be applied and subsequently updated to new facts and new conditions about the world. And so the Fourth Amendment does apply to surveillance. And the problem, of course, with the surveillance cases, and I am not a Fourth Amendment expert, but there is a line of cases that says if you give over information, even a telephone call, right, and that information goes to a third party, like a telecommunications company, that you have given up your right to privacy to that information. And the court may be reconsidering that soon, but originalism doesn't fail with respect to surveillance, at least insofar as the same principles that the founders wrote could and should apply. However, the court ends up deciding the question, it's not a situation in which originalism necessarily won't have an answer because the founders couldn't conceive of this.
Well, now I wasn't asking whether or not originalism is failing in the in interpreting these kinds of things, but it seems to me that there is a clear meaning with respect to things like papers and effects, and the effects seems like the most important word when you're talking about how modern governments engage in surveillance.
I think that's right. And for what it's worth, I think that also applies in administrative investigations. Often the government says you don't have a right to privacy in papers and effects or when you're running a heavily regulated business or something like that. And of course, most Americans today run or are parts of businesses where they would have papers and effects. And that's also a problem when you get a subpoena and you have to – for documents. The court says that that's not compelled testimony, even though the Fifth Amendment protects you against, you know, producing testimony against yourself. So there is a big problem with the extent and reach of government, I think, today. But I think originalism might have answers to those questions and in many respects are deviations from originalism. For example, in administrative investigations and administrative searches are a cause of a lot of our ills.
Well, what about war powers? Congress has done so much to delegate, perhaps unconstitutionally so, authorities to the executive branch.
So this is a very tough question, and Michael McConnell is actually working on a paper on this, which might even become a book. I think it's getting to that length. But it's very interesting, in fact, that the prerogative powers of the king back in Great Britain were actually divided up between the executive branch and the Congress. And when you look at the enumeration of powers in Article 1, Section 8, actually a significant chunk of them, maybe 7 or 8 of the powers, have to do with foreign affairs or traditionally prerogative executive powers. I don't want to do a disservice to Professor McConnell's thesis before his paper comes out, but his argument is actually that Congress has much more power to delegate the war powers or the prerogative powers to the executive because of the nature or character of those powers. But in that sense, it's important to keep in mind, the court has never really expounded on this, but the scope of the delegation or the scope of the power, the kind of power that Congress can exercise often should affect how much it's permitted to delegate. You know, so for example, its appropriations power, it often can't delegate that much power. But it's not clear that Congress shouldn't be able to delegate some more discretion to the executive with the war powers.
Is the non-delegation doctrine dead?
So I don't think it has to be. And this also is a topic that's a bit in my wheelhouse, and I also have done some writing on this. The non-delegation doctrine is dead in the sense that the courts, it's so powerful that the courts refuse to enforce it. It's so powerful, and this seems counterintuitive, but it's so powerful because the way the non-delegation doctrine is framed today, it's that either a statutory provision violates the non-delegation doctrine or it doesn't. So when a court is confronted with a non-delegation challenge, the question is, are we striking out the central provision of the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act? And that's why courts are so loath to actually use the non-delegation doctrine. But I do think there are ways that maybe the court, and in a paper that I'm working on, I actually call this as-applied non-delegation, might be able to cabin the non-delegation doctrine, to look at every regulation alone as applied rather than the statute that the regulation is promulgated pursuant to, and ask if Congress gave the agency the authority to make this regulation, would that be an unlawful delegation of legislative power? So to bring it back to your question, I do think the non-delegation doctrine is dead, but at least the way the courts have used it and applied it. But I think it can be revived. And in fact, I would encourage conservatives to think more creatively about the separation of powers and to find ways, like through an as-applied doctrine, to revive it.
I notice in your book you don't argue at all, it seems, with Lysander Spooner.
I have no argument with Lysander Spooner. He was also a big influence on Randy Barnett's book, if I'm remembering correctly.
Could you harmonize then the arguments that Lysander Spooner made in No Treason, which is essentially, you know, no living person authored the Constitution, and in the context of some of the wording in the Constitution itself, it doesn't actually bind anyone to obey the edicts of a government that exists underneath it?
So I have to confess that I've not read Spooner's No Treason. But this is in the same vein of Thomas Jefferson's argument, and Madison disagreed with it in his reply. Madison said that the Constitution creates a debt against future generations. And in the book, I argue that he was right. That goes to the question of whether the Constitution is good and legitimate and just. And the Lysander Spooner position and perhaps the Thomas Jefferson position can be stated as you need some sort of ongoing active consent of the governed, ongoing active acts of popular sovereignty. But I think Madison's view was a bit different, and the view of many other founders. And that view was essentially this, that the Constitution, for it to be good and just and legitimate and create this debt against the living, had to do what a good constitution, or I should say what a free constitution had to do, which is balance the two principal competing ends of free government. So that first end is creating a regime of self-government. On the other hand is protecting our natural liberties, our natural rights. And these are in tension with each other because it's often popular majorities that can infringe on the rights of others. And so balancing these competing objectives, these competing ends of government is no small task, and I argue is no easy task. And I argue in the book that the founders were remarkably successful at the way that they balanced these competing ends through rather ingenious mechanisms through separation of powers, checks and balances, the representative process, the division of federal and state powers, the enumeration of federal power, the protections of the Bill of Rights, which were considered the most essential rights necessary for a free society, for a free government. And that alone, I think, creates this debt against future generations. Having said that, that was not enough. The founders also said that for the Constitution to be worth more than the parchment on which it was written, it had to receive the approbation of the people. It had to be rooted in an act of popular sovereignty. Now, it is this ground that the Constitution is most criticized on, right? The founders excluded, the founders were slave owners. They excluded women from the process. Many states excluded the poor and the propertyless. But we must remember, we must remember that these things were not invented by the founders. These things were not their achievement. The slavery had been universal. The exclusion of women had been universal. The exclusion of the poor and the propertyless had been universal. The founders' achievement was transcending these historical traditions in very important ways, these historical limitations in important and profound ways. So their achievement was writing for the first time in a foundational national document that all men are created equal. As a result of which writing, by the way, over half the states between 1776 and 1787 abolished slavery or set a timetable for abolition. Their achievement was creating the first free government of the modern world, creating a regime of self-government also committed to the principle of equality under law. Remember, the Constitution has no property requirements for holding office. The Constitution abolished hereditary privileges and titles of nobility. And the body of the people who voted, who would deliberate and reflect on the ratification of the Constitution was broader than anywhere else in the world and at any time in history up until that time. So yes, I think we the living have progressed, and maybe we could write a better Constitution today if we tried. But I submit that we have progressed so much because we stand on the shoulders of giants. We stand on the shoulders of our founders.
You make an originalist defense of Brown v. Board of Education. What does that look like, and why is that a notable thing?
Yeah, so Brown v. Board is very, very important, not just for our constitutional culture and our civic culture today, but for originalism specifically, because it's often said that originalism can't justify Brown v. Board, and that that's a reason not to be originalist. So the first thing to say is again, to divide those inquiries that I divided at the beginning. The first question for an originalist is, what does the Constitution actually say? What does it mean? What does it require? And if it doesn't require Brown v. Board, then maybe we have to abandon the Constitution, or maybe that even justifies non-originalist interpretations. But with that framework in mind, I do think originalism can and always could defend Brown v. Board in this way. And I'll invoke here the legendary law professor Charles Black, who in 1960 said in a law review article that the justification for the desegregation decisions was awkwardly simple. Once it was known in the 1950s what all, you know, the Southerners knew, that the purpose of the segregation laws was the disadvantaging, the systematic disadvantaging of Black Americans, keeping them in a condition of inferiority and subordination. When it was known that that was the actual purpose of these laws, then the desegregation decisions are easy. They are clearly contrary to the text and principle of the 14th Amendment, which says you can't, as a state, enact laws that abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States on account of things like race. You can't deny them equal protection of the laws. So I sort of subscribe to the Charles Black school, where it doesn't matter what the people of this country, you know, if you took a poll in 1868 or 1872 or 1875, whether they wanted the 14th Amendment to apply to desegregation or thought it would. What matters is what they wrote. And once it was known what these desegregation, what these segregation laws actually accomplished and what their intended purpose was, I think they become easy under the 14th Amendment.
So what about laws that are their public understanding of the purpose of the law changes over time? That is to say, a law is passed with one intent, but it becomes known later that it also provides this other intent. Does that, in a case like Brown, does that change the analysis at all?
So I don't think so. At least if the original analysis had been, you know, properly done, I suppose we could discover other tools over time or other evidence that shapes our meaning, that shapes our understanding of the meaning. But the meaning, I think, doesn't necessarily change. The evidence that we have for discerning that meaning might change. But intent, remember what we're looking at is the original public meaning of the laws. The intent of the framers of any particular constitutional provision does matter. And I think, in fact, it rarely diverges from the public meaning. It might sometimes. But it's evidence of what the words mean. After all, why did they use those words? They had particular purposes in mind. That, you know, and that's how you can also look to background principles of law. All of these things come together to sort of shape our understanding of the public meaning of the laws. I don't think, the public meaning changes. It could be that our knowledge of what these provisions in fact objectively mean changes. So that's one possibility. And don't get me wrong, right? When I say that there's an objective public meaning, that doesn't mean there's no room for interpretation. It doesn't mean there won't be ambiguities or vagueness or indeterminacies, right? So one of my favorite examples is a statute that said it enhanced the penalty if a criminal defendant had used a gun in the commission of a crime. And this case, whose name is escaping me right now, the defendant traded his gun for drugs, to receive drugs. He didn't brandish it. He didn't threaten anyone with it. He traded it for guns. Well, does that fall under the public meaning of using a gun? I don't know. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. There's textual arguments on both sides. And so public meaning, that there's an objective public meaning, doesn't mean that there won't be room for interpretation and debate and that we can learn more. It doesn't mean we can't learn more over time about what the public meaning might actually be.
What is the most clear-cut example, in your view, in this originalist view, of what Antonin Scalia would have called constitutional but stupid?
Constitutional but stupid. Well, does the income tax count? I mean, I say that in jest. I'm not completely anti-tax. I consider myself, somewhere in between libertarian and conservative politically. But there it is, in black and white. The 16th Amendment permits the federal income tax. The 17th Amendment permits the direct election of senators. There are good things to these provisions and also bad things. And, on the whole, do I think maybe we'd be better off without a federal income tax? Do I think we might be better off if senators weren't directly elected? Probably. I think over time, especially if you believe in limiting federal power and maximizing individual liberty, then I think, those are constitutional but stupid. How stupid, I won't stake out a position right now. But those would be some clear-cut examples.
Ilan Werman is author of A Debt Against the Living, An Introduction to Originalism. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.